What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 124, The Female Athlete in Social Media, featuring Megan Jeffries. Did I say that right, Megan?
You did.
I keep wanting to say Jeffries, but you're missing a letter. So Jeffries. I am your host, Jeremy Jackson. Sitting right next to me is
Jose.
Shakira. Gabby.
And then we are joined by Nicole Kasha, Dr. Josh Yellen, Tashari Lewis, and then asking some of the questions today will be
Matthew.
All right, good, Matthew. We're missing Jess. She's a class president, so she's got some other work to do. If you want to join the conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. That's where it has the link to the CEU live event. The Ustream social feature is Bernice. She's over there watching the Ustream, and that's our backup recording. Again, our website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, is where you would register for the CEU live event. And I see we got three people logged in there now. Who do we have there, Shakira?
Robert, Catherine, and Michael.
All right, so Robert, Catherine, and Michael, hello. Thanks for joining us. Again, if you have questions in the live stream, the little chat box down at the bottom, and Shakira will see and ask those questions. But without much further ado, Matthew?
Please tell us about yourself briefly.
Well, hello. My name is Megan Jeffries, as I've already been introduced. I am a graduate student at Missouri State University. I am an athletic trainer at a local high school as well. I moved from Washington State all the way to Missouri State. And that's because if I was going to get graduate school paid for, I was going to just travel across the country. That's basically kind of what I did. I've been an athletic trainer for 2 years now, and I went to Eastern Washington University for undergrad.
It's a good school.
And it is. Go Eagles. And you've got the awesome Red Field if you haven't heard of it. And I really am passionate about the female athlete and a lot of the psychosocial issues that they go through and things like that.
What are you getting your master's in?
Master's of Science in Athletic Training.
From Missouri State.
Yes.
Good.
All right. So Dr. Yellen is the program director for the Masters of Athletic Training at the University of Houston. So
you can look us up at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT.
So he's always interested in the college and the degree plan or anything like that. So very cool. All right. So Megan, when is your paper going to be published?
I will be defending my thesis in March, and then I'm going to work on getting it into a manuscript and getting it into a journal.
Megan, tell me, who are your advisors?
My advisors are Dr. Tanya Hetzler and Shannon Derricks, who's an athletic trainer at Missouri State University. And she's worked with a lot of volleyball, gymnastics teams, and she's dealt with a lot of issues with body image. Mm-hmm. And then Dr. Michael Hudson.
And I hope I'm not stealing anybody's thunder. Is that all right? What got you interested in this? What are some of the factors that you saw? You just brought up psychosocial issues in sport, especially in the female athlete. What got you interested in identifying this?
Well, at undergrad, my program director was Dr. Jeff Kawaguchi, and he did a lot of research with female athletes as well. Uh-huh. And it really kind of just, I spent a lot of time with him. He was my ACI in undergrad. I spent a large portion of my time doing a lot of his classwork and whatnot. And so a lot of his research kind of got me thinking, well, this is a big issue. He did a lot more of like orthopedic injuries type things, but I like to look at more of the psychosocial stuff just because they're so, not that they're vulnerable, but it's just different for females.
Correct. That is a correct statement.
Do you have any personal experience with social media causing body image issues?
Body image issues, yes. Directly because of social media, not quite. I like to think that nobody goes into researching about body image issues unless they've done it or had gone through that themselves. It's kind of a really touchy subject for a lot of people, but for me, it was like, well, if I was an athlete and I felt like this, well, what's causing that? And why are there other athletes that were like me that were experiencing this as well? So that's another, that was another aspect of why I wanted to get into this. But yes, I have gone through body image issues, and it was quite an interesting time.
What sport did you participate in?
I played fast pitch softball and volleyball.
At the high school or collegiate level, or both?
I played softball at the collegiate level.
Okay, so you were both a softball player and athletic training student at the same time.
No, I went to a junior college first, and then I transferred to a 3-year program.
All right, so you stopped playing in junior college?
Yes.
Okay, and then you transferred into the ATEP program at Washington?
Yes.
Eastern Washington, yeah, okay.
All right, so in your paper, which you've sent us the rough draft, and I've read a little bit of it, and Dr. Yellen read some of it, or I try to read it, but I get confused by all the numbers. I'm not a stats guy. I remember taking statistical analysis and seeing the R value, but I don't remember what it does. So, but you had actually made a reference to your own struggle with body issues or something like that. If you're comfortable, was any of that like eating disorder type thing?
No. Well, it was more of disordered eating, and it's important to know that disordered eating and eating disorders are not one and the same. It was more of a, well, here I have 5 minutes to eat, so let's scarf something down before I get to practice or before I get to class or something like that. And there were days where it was just like, well, I've already eaten a lot today, so I'm not gonna eat a big dinner, big breakfast, big lunch, whatever it is. And it was a lot of cognitive process, a deeper thought process of what I had eaten that day or something like that.
So go into, I think Jeremy is right. I think you kind of opened up the can on this one. So for those that are not in the know or those that have not really paid attention to these two very different terms, although they sound alike, one is disordered eating, the other one is eating disorders, right? So can you go into a little bit further into, right, the disordered eating is more of a cognitive process, where the eating disorder is more of a pathological process. Mm-hmm. So can you elaborate on both those?
Well, as far as my research, I didn't go very deep into either of them, but a part of body satisfaction issues and body image issues is a cascade. So eating or disordered eating and low body satisfaction can lead to eating disorders. It's kind of like, it's not, you don't just decide one day that you're going to have an eating disorder. It's a lot of different factors that lead into it, and disordered eating is a big part of that, as well as, well, here's the influence of my body image, here's the influence of other people telling me I'm not good enough, or me not thinking I'm not good enough, or something like that, that leads into that eating disorders.
So can you get in a little bit more into body image, especially as it affects the female athlete? You know, the one thing that influenced me when I was writing my thesis was that back in the day where athletic training students could travel with the team on their own, I was assigned to the Cal State Northridge softball team, and I was there for the entire semester. And I saw a double standard in terms of sociological acceptance standards. You know, on one hand, you had these male athletes. So if I categorize, you know, a male baseball team versus a female softball team, right, there are these sociological factors that go into that. On one hand, the female had to perform very well on the field of competition, whether that was going to be softball, volleyball, basketball, etc. And they also had to fit into sociological norms. They had to look a certain way and act a certain way and dress a certain way, including makeup and hair and perfume and heels or not heels. Whereas the male, they didn't necessarily have those sociological standards, right? The male can walk into the locker room and not be shaved and not even showered and walk out of the locker room after the game the same way, and nobody looked, you know, nobody cared any bit about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can you elaborate a little bit on that, on the sociological, what you found in your research, the sociological phenomenon that causes both disordered eating and eating disorders?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a lot of part of my research was the fact that there's completely two different constructs in which female athletes have to kind of figure out and kind of see, well, here's what I can do about this one and here's what I can do about that one. And managing the differences between the everyday out of competition lifestyle versus the in competition on the field and doing good things in the classroom as well. And it's from what I read through my qualitative research is the fact that they have a really hard time trying to figure that out, because really it's like, well, some days I feel good about my body and some days I don't feel good about my body. And some days I just feel lucky that I think I look better than this classmate of mine who doesn't play sports in college. And it's just really surprising that they think that it's two different worlds that they have to live in, but really they kind of have to merge them into one to make them feel really good about themselves.
And how does that affect their performance? So, for instance, I remember I dealt with a softball player, and the softball player was larger than the average norm for a female. What I say is that larger in terms of height and larger in terms of body weight. I think she was like, 5'10", and, was 180-something pounds. But for her height, she was a great weight, and, she was able to participate athletically and, all those other things. She struggled with, I can be in the gym and she could squat, 300 pounds. But when she looks at her friend who's, 5'2", 100 pounds, this now started this cascade of events of, well, I'm not 5'2", and I'm not 100 pounds, and I don't fit into a size zero. And so I did a lot of work with, you are what you are, and you look normal for your size and height, but you're not fitting into these sociological norms. What did you find?
I found a lot of the same thing. And what I really found was the differences may not really matter that much, but it's that person's social comparison to whatever model that they want to compare themselves to. What they think about their body is what they think about their body. And whatever, so say I have a negative body image because of this, and this reason, when I'm looking at things, I'm going to really pay attention to ads, advertisements, or media or whatever that are more negative, because that's what I think about my body. And I'm going to construe things that are negative because that's how I think about myself. But if you have a positive body image, you're going to think, well, yes, that might be true, or, that might be a negative ad, but that's okay because I'm not going to pay attention to it. And the fact that it's completely different standards, because this person who's 5'10" and this person who is 5'2" physiologically can't be the same,
right?
Because of height, weight, and their bone structure, their muscle compilation, stuff like that. And because this 5'10 person is comparing herself to a 5'2 person, the fact that that just doesn't, there's a really big rift there because they physiologically cannot be similar.
But sociologically, right. That's the phenomenon.
That's the part. Yes. That's the part that really screws a person up.
Right.
In, for lack of a better term. And the fact that the psychological and the sociological comparison is what drives a lot of these issues.
So do you think some sort of psychological inventory needs to be a part of pre-participation examinations?
That could help, but I don't believe that that's going to catch everything. I mean, I didn't do a lot of research on other psychological testing, like the inventories or anything like that. I didn't go down that route. I took the body esteem scale, mm-hmm. and then I researched that and put it towards the responses that I got. But they're good starting points, but like in any other testing that we have, like concussion testing, baseline testing, anything like that, it's a good start, but it's not going to be perfect.
Yeah, you're not going to catch everything.
Yeah.
Right. I throw a net in the water, I'm not going to catch all the fish.
Right, right.
I'm going to catch some.
So do you know if they have shown that certain personalities have somehow been known to show that there's more of a susceptibility to an eating disorder than other personalities?
I'm sure there is. I didn't do research. I didn't focus my research on that, but I think that people who are more vulnerable to social comparison are going to be the ones that you're really going to be worried about.
Yeah, so if they can somehow create like a questionnaire or some sort of exam for prevention, purposes
that, and... Yeah, that would definitely be helpful. But, body image issues that I've seen are within 2 or 3 people, and that's been within my 5-year experiences with athletic training. I mean, it's definitely not the norm, but it's definitely not something that we can just say, well, it's only a minority of people, it's not really that big of an issue. But it really is for those, that population that do have the body image issues.
Yeah, or maybe it could perhaps stem from uneducated, just those who are uneducated in health and food, as far as like what's right to eat if you're an athlete. And
yeah,
well, yesterday we always practice for the episode so that my kids have an idea of what we're talking about, and one of the things that I mentioned, and I've talked about it with my wife, is that Facebook and Twitter, those are everybody's best moments. No, people don't usually take an Instagram selfie looking bad. Like I told him yesterday, they don't look ratchet and take an Instagram photo because they want to put their best out there. And so all we're seeing is people's best. So then I'm comparing my normal to their best all the time because that's what I see. Oh, well, everybody looks this way because everybody on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or whatever is looking so cute, right? Like Bob or Jose looking so cute. I'm just kidding. And so that's what we're comparing ourselves to, and we're raising the standard unrealistically. And so, I mean, I know that in your research or preliminary research, you know, you came to some results. And so I just find it hard to believe that in general that social media doesn't negatively affect people.
Well, and don't forget also in all these advertisements, we have this magical, you know, application called Photoshop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in Photoshop, I can make anybody look like anything at any time. Mm-hmm. So if I don't like this curve or if I don't like that mark or if I don't like that height or that weight or that shape, I can change it, right? And that's what people start to see. And that's what they start to compare themselves to. And it's just now you're back into that psychosocial phenomenon of this cascade of events of I don't fit into the social norm and, boy, I'm really hungry and I'd really love to, you know, plow through this double cheeseburger and french fries, but I can't. Why? You know, well, because I need to be able to maintain a certain weight or a certain this or a certain that. Whereas the, you know, the conversation in the head should be, look, I'd really love to be able to plow through this double cheeseburger and french fries because I'm hungry and, you know, in a few hours, I need to participate in this event. And this is going to give me the right fuel source because of X, Y, and Z or not, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the thing with my research is the fact that it may or may not be because of social media. It could be it definitely could be an influencing factor. But like I said, it's not only social media that's been the problem. I think a lot of news sources have tried to pin things on social media, but really, I think it's too naive to try to pin it on one source of the problem.
So, what do you think it's coming from?
I think it's coming from a lot of different factors, and it's a lot of environment. It could be moms, dads, coaches. There have been studies that show that athletes feel pressured because their coaches think that they need to lose weight or they need to be at certain weights to perform the best that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And is that really necessary? Does that coach think it's necessary for them to be 135 for a cross-country runner, or do they need to be lower just because they can be that much faster? Right. I mean, is that backed up by research? Well, we don't really know because they just say, I think this 5'5 girl needs to be 122 pounds to be able to run a 5K at a very good rate or something like that. And really, that's more of just old school coaching kind of things and things that are not necessarily uneducated, but poorly researched to become more of the norm.
You know, I always classify it as if you've ever been a part of any baseball scouting, right, you've always got the scout, and the scout can either see or hear the pitch, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've got the speed gun, and we've got all these analytics now to be able to quantify this kind of this sociological data. And so how I always try to put it in frame is, yeah, that scout's out there to say, I think the pitcher is this and I think the pitcher is that. But what are we looking for, right? We're looking for some hard data to back up what we're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question I would have posed for you is, do you think that you can take any of these scales and start to quantify them so that you can start to change some of the sociological and psychological behaviors?
That would be a very hard thing to do, because what I noticed with the girls, with the participants so it's a self-report survey, but then once I asked them about it and they were able to write in an answer,
mm-hmm.
their scores didn't match up or their attitudes didn't match up. So mm-hmm. they would put their body steam at a pretty high level. But then once I asked them, well, how do you think about your body as an athlete, or how do you think about your body as a woman in society? And they would say, well, not so great about the qualitative stuff, like they're written in answers, but they still rated themselves as a really high body esteem. So that to me didn't match up. And I think it's more of a conversation that you need to have, or they need to have with somebody about it to be able to kind of sort into groups per se.
So when you say a conversation with somebody about it, who are you making reference to? Athletic trainer, psychologist, psychiatrist, counselor, who?
That's up to either the athlete or that's up to the athletic trainer. I mean, especially in colleges, because you have so many resources, you have those, and you need to, like, as athletic trainers, I believe that it's necessary to know who to be able to send where. Mm-hmm. And being able to have those relationships with those counselors, those nutritionists, those psychologists, to be able to send their athletes to, and even with orthopedic doctors, things like that, just having to know your resources is the biggest issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, so I got a question from Catherine Rosa in the chat room. And since you played both volleyball and softball, what was your finding or what is your opinion on the uniform affecting body image? Because obviously volleyball, they wear the tights, and so everybody could see their booty and whether or not they're cellulite.
Yeah. And I was having a conversation with Nicole and Tashari on the way over here. You know, I'm from Southern California, and at Long Beach State, we participate a lot in beach volleyball. So those outfits even get skimpier.
Yeah.
You know?
And there has been research on female athletes' attitudes towards the volleyball uniform, and it's kind of like a mixed thing there again, where some of them are saying, you know, I don't really have a whole lot of body image issues, so the uniform doesn't bother me that much. But then you have the girls who think, oh, well, I hate the way I look in my uniform, and that it affects my competition. It affects the way I play, how I think, my confidence, my attention to what I'm doing. And I mean, their attitude towards the uniform can change everything for them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I worked with a volleyball coach, and he routinely would come out with this statement. Okay, the team needs to lose X amount of weight. And so if you had an athlete that, you know, knew that she was a little bit overweight, then she would say, yeah, I need to drop a couple pounds. But if you had an athlete that was at or below weight and already had a pathological mode of thinking, this sent her into a cascade, you know, where she just spiraled out of control, and we had to intervene. So let me ask you a question. Along those lines, you had mentioned before being able to refer to the right sources. How involved do you think the athletic trainer should be in being able to speak with the athlete, being able to speak with the coach, intervening when you see pathological signs and symptoms, and even a psychosocial phenomenon?
Well, I think the athletic trainer needs to be involved to the point where he or she doesn't get too affected by it. With me, I think at the high school level, I know I've had athletes come to me and they said, Megan, I've thought so-and-so, thought about maybe even like suicide, something like that. Mm. And I was the first person that they came to talk about that. I've heard about athletic trainers who have had student athletes come to them talking about drug addictions, things like that. And I think it's important that as athletic trainers, we're the people that they are comfortable enough to talk to about that. And we need to have the education, and we need to know where to go with that information that they have trusted us enough to give. I think it's important that we're supportive of getting help if that's what they want, or just being that person that they vent to or something like that. Sometimes I would caution on getting too involved with female athletes and their issues with their body image, but or even any psychosocial issue for that matter. But I definitely think it's important that we have that relationship where they feel that they trust us enough to come to us with those problems, because we do have the power to be able to say, hey, coach, or hey, I need to get you into the doctor, or hey, let's think about going this way, let's think about going this route, things like that.
So when you say, you mentioned, quote, getting too involved a couple times, can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Getting too involved would probably, and that's different for everybody, I would believe. I would think that as long as you're not being like, you can go to bed at night and you can lay down your head and you can go to sleep without having any other issues.
It'd just be like any other rehab, you know. If I'm doing ACL rehab, I'm not up at night worrying about, you know, did I do this right? Did I do this wrong? You know, this is part of your patient load, and that's what you need to do.
What about being able to recognize signs, like as far as approaching the athlete if you do see signs that they are kind of struggling with body image or have some sort of psychological sign going on? Like, if you are able to recognize that sign, should you approach the athlete at that point, or not really get involved, wait for them to approach you? What is your opinion on that?
For me, I would say a lot of their behaviors would be kind of just little comments about their body image. There aren't very many overt trouble signs. I know there's a lot of body checking behaviors, and that's not a lot of things that I see, especially because I'm in the athletic training room. I don't have any mirrors or anything in there, and they would do that in the locker room or something like that amongst their teammates. But mostly what I hear is little comments like, man, I have such big thighs, or, you know, when I sit down, my thighs are huge, and things like that. And as far as approaching the athlete, that depends on their comfort level with you and your comfort level with them, because those can be two different things with athletes. As far as approaching them, though, that kind of depends on how well they respond to that. If they're an athlete or if they just don't respond to somebody coming up and saying, hey, can we talk? Then that's not the right approach that you need to take. You need to kind of study how they respond to criticism or suggestions or something like that. You kind of just need to even go from it at like their teammates' sides and say, pull one of their teammates apart or away and say, hey, how is so-and-so doing? I kind of see something going on, but what do you see with her? Or what do you see with him? Like kind of going around the issue until it becomes too monumental.
So knowing what signs and behaviors to look for, and then also knowing your athlete at the same time.
Absolutely.
I think that's what makes the athletic trainer an incredibly valuable resource as compared to other allied healthcare professionals, that we have this really constant interaction with most of the patients that we deal with, right? So whether you're an athletic trainer in a traditional setting like a sports team, or whether you're in the occupational setting or physician extender, whatever it is, you are probably interacting with that athlete or that patient more than most. So you're going to be able to see these different nuances that most can't. So kind of parlaying into that. So let's just say that you do have a high school athlete and you're starting to notice these subtle nuances that you described, but this is a high school athlete, and obviously the athlete would be a minor in this situation. Can you kind of describe the process that you would take in order to get this person the right help? I mean, obviously they're a minor, so you have to take into consideration parental factors, you have to take into consideration coaching factors and psychological factors. So what are some of the things that you would employ based on some of the research that you found?
Well, a lot of it is, in my opinion, and what I've dealt with, I would definitely talk to the athlete first. I wouldn't want to set off an alarm with administrators or a school psychologist or anything like that before I knew what was really going on. Because sometimes you feel this hunch and sometimes you're wrong. So there's always that, you just need to know, is it or is it not having an issue in their life? I would definitely, obviously.
I want to stop you right there. So how are you going to confirm that hunch?
And that's talking with the athlete or talking with teammates or even talking with teachers sometimes too.
And so what are some of the questions you think you would bring up to the athlete or the teacher or maybe even the coach?
Well, I would talk to teammates and say, or even friends at high school, say, hey, how is she eating lately? Or how is she doing in her general life? I mean, a lot of environmental factors like stress from work, stress from school, stress from homework, stuff like that can lead into these things. And just say, hey, how is so-and-so doing? Is she okay? Like, I mean, and honestly, a lot of high schoolers are like, yeah, I guess so. I mean, she's kind of been a little bit weird lately. So I'm constantly comparing, their mind is like about 5 feet away from their bodies,
right.
In a lot of different ways. So they usually don't give me like a straight up answer. And so you kind of have to go around it a bunch of different ways. You kind of have to ask the same question in a different format. Sometimes that can get really annoying, but that's how you just got to do it. And so you kind of see what's going on in their life, with their family, and not necessarily really have to get into depth about it. As long as, if it's not like, if the teammate, friend, coach, teacher doesn't say something about well, she's really struggling with this, or she's really struggling with that. It's more of a, well, she's just not acting normal lately. And that's more of how you kind of confirm or not confirm that hunch.
Yeah, I certainly understand that. I have a son that he's going into ninth grade next year. We just went to his high school orientation last night. And Matthew, his name is, you know, Matthew, call him Matt. Matt is at the age that the only thing he really cares about are sports and girls. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, a dragon can show up into his room and spit fire from the dragon's mouth, and Matt wouldn't even, he wouldn't even know it existed. So I certainly understand, you know, when you're trying to rephrase questions to high school kids, a lot of times you have to ask the same question five different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so now I want to progress a little bit more, right? So you identified a possibility of either disorder eating or eating disorder in a high school athlete. And you've started this investigation, right? And I'm going to say that you've talked to, you know, maybe a coach, or you've talked to some teammates, or you even talked to that athlete, and you're not really alarmed. You're just starting to observe a couple things. A couple things that bounce into my mind. One, is any of the questioning a HIPAA violation in your mind?
Well, in my mind, no, but it could be construed that way because I'm not talking to the parent first.
Okay. So second of all, moving forward, let's just say that the hunch is confirmed, right? That in fact this, and we'll say for right now a female athlete, the female athlete has a negative body image, you know, some sort of body distortion.
Right.
And it's leading into this kind of pathological condition, you know, and we'll just categorize that as, can I use the category as deviant behavior? Would you feel comfortable with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're looking at this kind of deviant behavior. So at what point, now tell me the process. So we've identified that it exists. We've confirmed our hunch. Now tell me, okay, I've really got something here. Where do you go from there?
From there, I would definitely go to the parents and say, hey, I've been noticing this. I don't know if you've noticed this, and maybe you have, and let's work together to get her, this athlete, to where she needs to be, to either talk to somebody or be seen by somebody and get her the treatment that she needs to be able to change that body image for her. You could also give a heads up to school administrators, because they can talk to either the counselors, the school psychologist, the school nurse, whatever resources they have at the school, to be able to kind of intervene and talk to that athlete as well. For my position, I am contracted through Mercy Sports Medicine, which is a part of the hospital. So I have that great relationship with my orthopedic doctors, and we have a sports psychologist in our clinic to be able to say, hey, can we get this person in to be seen by our sports psychologist?
And so at what factor do you think the coach plays in this? And then I have another question for you after that.
I think coach, depending on coach's attitudes, they can be a big factor in this. I know working at the high school the past couple of years, I've noticed this thing, what I've termed like injury shaming, that coaches make their athletes feel bad about being injured. Mm-hmm. And so what do they do about their, you know, if they have a negative body image as a coach, do they impart that upon their athletes or the other way around?
Yeah, you have a lot of coaches that use athletes as, and to use a business term, right, as a commodity,
mm-hmm.
right? This athlete is supposed to perform a certain way. So, you know, in the business world, if I invest in a stock, that stock is supposed to perform a certain way. It's going to make me money, or it's going to stabilize the rest of my portfolio, or whatever it is. The athlete is the same way. The athlete is there to do a job. And if that athlete can't do the job, then a lot of coaches look at that athlete as, you're no of no use to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to either, you know, replace you or demote you or whatever it is, without any consideration for the psychological factors
mm-hmm.
that go into that. So one of the questions I have is that, given the situation that you're in, so let's talk about your team physician, right? We all know in the sports medicine world, we deal with orthopedists all the time. And most of our referrals are going to go to the orthopedic surgeon. However, in the, you know, and I'll categorize your setting as the pediatric setting. Is your team physician a pediatrician that's sports medicine fellowship trained, or is it a family practice, or is it an orthopedic surgeon? What are your recommendations along those lines?
Well, we actually have pediatrics who are trained in sports medicine. We have a very comprehensive clinic where I am. So we have orthopedics, and we also have pediatricians, and we have a really great relationship with both. We kind of have two separate sports medicine clinics, and we have pediatrics in one, and then we have our orthopedics in the other. Mm-hmm. And so we have where our pediatrics doctors actually love us. They call us physician extenders, especially even in the high school role. And they,
that's really what you are, you know,
Yeah. And so we have a really great relationship with them, and they also have the resources to say, well, this person needs to go to a psychologist, or this person just needs to go to a nutritionist, and let's get this sports psychologist involved and things like that. So we're very interconnected where I am.
That's good. And so in the setting that you're at, you know, obviously, as we discover more about learning disabilities and stuff like that, do you have access to, you know, let's say a patient's on Adderall, and that Adderall is a stimulant and decreases the patient's appetite. Do you have access to that type of information to add to some of your diagnoses?
If it's on the pre-participation physical, then yes, I do. But unless it's on there, I do not have that access. I can get into, we have our electronic medical records. Mm-hmm. And if it's on there and one of my athletes is a part of the Mercy system, then I can kind of look at their patient file. But unless they're not with us. So we have two kind of major hospitals in the area. And if they're a patient of a hospital in the other, if they're a patient in the other hospital, I don't have access to that.
I understand.
All right. So Josh, you talked about this briefly, or asked this question about the coach, the importance of a coach. And so specifically, I'm thinking of an example. We have a 12-year-old girl that we know. She's in cheer. So recently she's gone over some stuff for a possible stress fracture in her interlumbar spine. Pretty mm-hmm. typical mm-hmm. when you're doing competitive cheer. But the mm-hmm. coach is like hounding this girl who's got an athletic build as a 12-year-old mm-hmm. to be on a diet. So like, we have donuts at church on Sunday, and she's like, well, I can't eat that donut because my coach won't let me. So Megan or Dr. Yellen, what are your thoughts on that? And obviously that's affecting body image, yeah. But a 12-year-old girl in competitive cheer,
who by the way has a suspected stress fracture in her lumbar spine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's recent, though.
What's that?
So that was just recent. Like in the last few weeks, we've kind of discovered that, but.
Yeah, but she got it from competition.
Without a doubt.
She didn't get it from walking to school.
Right.
Right.
So the body image aspect of telling a 12-year-old that mm-hmm. sticking to a strict diet.
Megan, you want to take this one first, and I'll follow up?
Yeah. I mean, that's a hard situation. And as a 12-year-old, she really has the ability to be able to eat those donuts on Sunday. Like, I mean, even in competitive cheer, she's doing a lot as a 12-year-old to be able to kind of counteract those calories. But honestly, that is a really tough situation. And that's when you really need to go to the coach and say, hey, it's what you're telling these girls is to have a negative body image. And you're telling your girls to not eat something at 12 years old. They're going to carry that for the rest of their life. So, and that's hard for, as a cheer coach, I could see a lot of potential backfire with that, because they could be like, well, I did it when I was a young kid. And that's just, it's unsupported in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, a lot of times a coach will come up to me and go, well, this is what I did when I was coming through. And I would point out to the coach, well, you know, we also have mobile phones and internet and Facebook, and none of that existed when you were going through. So, you know, we're going to adapt to change. The mm-hmm. first thing that comes to my mind is burnout. And, mm-hmm. you know, you've got this 12-year-old girl who you're already trying to categorize in these sociological norms. And more than likely, this girl got into cheer for some reason or another other than the fact that she liked to cheer. So she probably got into cheer or gymnastics or whatever it was because her friend next door decided to go to cheer or gymnastics. So little Molly's going to go, so I'm going to go, right? And it's a way to kind of make friends and get along with people and be part of a group outside of school and, you know, some other commitments that you may have. And then at some point, this girl was either encouraged or she noticed that she had some physical talent in cheer. So she kept, you know, moving on, and she was part of these cheer competitions and going on and on. And part of that, you start to fit into these sociological norms. Well, you know, now that she's got this issue of, look, you know, you need to be able to drop some weight. First of all, as a 12-year-old girl, you're just starting to go through puberty, right? So your body's changing and your hips are changing and your The curves are changing. The contours are changing. So that's one physiological factor. The psychological factor that goes with that, just like we see, you know, as a kid can be really tall or really short as compared to their peers. If you start to see a male or a female go through puberty before or after, that has a major sociological factor, right? So all these confounding factors go in. And on top of it, the coaches come in and say, you can't eat that donut on Sunday. That donut's doing nothing for you. It can't do anything to hurt you, and it can't do anything to help you, right? It's just a donut. And I'm going to go on a limb and say that I'm older than all of you, which I think I am, right? So I'm 40, and guess what? When we were growing up, we ate whatever we wanted, and we went out and we participated, and you didn't have all these other factors. You have another phenomenon to this, too. When I was 12 years old, we didn't specialize in sports. Now you're seeing this phenomenon of sports specialization. And you're having a lot of these sports medicine professionals coming out and saying, no, don't do that. For a number of reasons. One, we're starting to see injuries like this low back fracture. That shouldn't happen in a 12-year-old. The only reason why it's there is because it's sports specialization. She's constantly taxing that part of the body. It can't handle it anymore. Just like we're seeing, you know, these ulnar collateral ligaments in the elbow in 12 and 13-year-old kids. You shouldn't see that. The other part about that is this kind of psychological phenomenon that goes with it. You know, at 12 or 13 or 14, if you're being pushed that hard in this one sport, what's going to happen when you get to 17, 18, 19 years old? What happens if, let's say you're a good cheerleader, or a good gymnast, or a good football player, baseball player, whatever it is, and you've been participating in that sport for the majority of your life, and you're constantly being pushed, and by the time you get to college, let's say you're a scholarship athlete, you want nothing to do with this anymore. You know why? Because you're burnt out. I don't want to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think a lot of coaches, a lot of parents especially, I see at times where, you know, the parent lives vicariously through that kid. You know, like, I didn't make anything of myself in athletics, so I'm going to have you do it, son or daughter. Or this is going to be great, right? And you push and push and push and push. These kids can't take it. So, mm-hmm. You know, I have a 13-and-a-half-year-old son. And I have a 10-and-a-half-year-old daughter. And, you know, my son, he's not necessarily growing at the rate of some of, you know, he's got some friends that are like 6'1". These kids are 13. 6'1", 205 pounds. Okay, that's great. You know, and the parents are on this kid about, we're going to send you to football camp. We're going to do this and we're going to do that. No, don't do that. Let the kid go skateboarding. If the kid wants to go hula hoop in the front yard, let him do that. Because what we're really starting to see is your ability to do well in sports is an overall athletic, ability. It's not your ability to specialize in one sport. I would say the same thing for psychological factors. Your ability to do well and survive in society says that you have to be able to survive in all these other different factors, right? And so if you're only used to surviving in one area, I'm only used to interacting with softball players or gymnasts or football players or baseball players. What happens when you get out to the rest of society and you realize nobody cares, right? So there are all these different sociological norms, and especially at a very fragile age, we have to be able to develop these kids to take on the world, not necessarily take on, you know, a cheerleading competition. I'll step off my soapbox. No, it's not. We can't hear you. But you can yell really loudly. Okay.
All right. So to sum that up, I would say that that it's not a good idea for a cheer coach to tell a 12-year-old to stick to a strict diet.
No.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just to sum all that up, and to exactly not right. Specialize in sports.
Well done. Well so. Done, sir.
All right. I got a question from Rob DeJohn, and I was going to try and say it over there, but he asked about... let me read it.
Oh, okay. All right, fine. Let's hope I can read. Where are my glasses? All right. What type of impact do you feel body image has on self-esteem, and do you think self-respect has a factor to do with that?
Is that a me for me?
That's a question for you. You want me to read it again?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, body image and and self-esteem kind of go hand in hand. They're not completely the same concepts, but they are very similar, and a lot of them have to do with the same factors. Body image, the way you think about, I mean, if you're 5'6", 130, I mean, you're going to be a little bit skinnier than the person who's 5'6", and 150, and that's the way it is. I mean, and even the composition of your body and where people carry their weight, it's just going to be different. But I mean, your body image of yourself and your self-esteem kind of could just go hand in hand, because there's this really big picture of how many factors really go into self-esteem, body image, things like that. Okay, so what was the second part of that question? Maybe I didn't get that.
I think it or had was to it? Do with, can you put the question up again? Thanks, hang on. Self-respect.
Self-respect, absolutely. I mean, you have respect for your body. I mean, right. People slip up, you're going to have a donut. Oh, crap, you know? But when you have your next meal, whatever, and you have put something good in your body, then and you're respecting your body, that's awesome. When you go exercise and when you do good things and you feel good about it, that's also another part of that adds to your self-respect and adds to your body image and your self-esteem, things like that.
So yeah. I do have a question. Okay, so what if you have a situation where a person you feel needs help doesn't want your help? Like, how do you go about it then? Like, do you go around them and, like, talk to their parents? Then what if the parents are, like, kind of, you know, nothing wrong with my child, but you're so sure and they're showing signs that, hey, something's going on in this person's life. Then how do you approach the situation?
I would definitely find somebody who they respect and they respond to and have them talk to them about it. And whether or not they want to take that relationship and they want to take that conversation away from me, that's fine. As long as that athlete is having that conversation with someone is the most important part. And that they find somebody that they respect to be able to get that that information back from. If the parents are also kind of so-so about things, and a lot of parents don't really want to say, yes, my child has a problem, or no, my child doesn't have a problem. They're more on the side of, how dare you even say this about my kid? I mean, that's a lot of the reality that I live in, especially at the high school. They kind of just, parents don't want to accept the fact that maybe this kid does have a concussion. Maybe this kid does have a body image issue. And as for me, I would definitely go and find that person that they do respond to and find that person that the parents respond to be able to get that information across in a more respectful manner and a more, and somebody that those parents, that athlete holds in high regard to finally understand the severity of the situation.
Let me jump in real quick. I actually had a situation where a girl came to get some tape to cover up her arm. I was like, well, what do you need that for? And she with the other student, were kind of sheepish. And so then, you know, after, I don't know, a minute or so, she showed me her arm. She had been cutting her arm. Mm. And so she's like, please don't tell anybody. I was like, look, I won't tell the coach, but I have to tell the counselor. Mm-hmm. I have to let the administration know. Because here in high school, I mean, besides the fact that I could lose my job and never be able to teach again, that kind of thing, I don't know. But the fact that this is a serious issue, I legally have to tell the counselor. Sure. I have to report it. And so at that point, it's not, hey, I'm betraying your trust. It's, hey, understand, I have to tell somebody, and then it's going to go from there. And so, the counselor's the best person, best trained person, I would say, in the school to deal with those issues, mm-hmm. because it extends far beyond what's on the court. So I would think, Shari, if someone came to me and said, hey, I've been, puking after every meal I eat for the last 6 weeks, well, either we need to get you to a doctor because you have some sort of serious stomach bug, or you have an eating disorder. And so at that point, it's, I have to tell somebody, I have to do this because, one, I care about you, and two, because it's my job, it's my responsibility as an adult. So
yeah, legally, I have to be able to refer you to the right sources, right? And I'm bound by law and I'm bound by ethics to do so. This can get really hard. I think you bring up a really good point. We see this a lot with a lot of parents that we deal with. And, I've done high school outreach for the majority of my career. I think I was involved in high school outreach definitely over a decade, but I can't pinpoint how many years. And we came across, quite a bit what you guys referenced to. I've come across parents that obviously their son or daughter is concussed, and the parent has come out and said, I'll sign whatever document you need me to sign to allow my child to play. We've seen cases where, the child obviously has been, some sort of cycle of pathological eating, and we've identified this. No, you don't understand. You know, my daughter is this, or even in, you know, on the male side, I've noticed that this child exhibits a lot of the signs and symptoms of steroid abuse. Oh, there's no way that my son or daughter is engaged in steroid abuse. And when you show them, look, this is all the physiological signs, and this is everything that your son or daughter has. And so we need to be able to refer you to the right resource. So the parents at times can be either A, your biggest advocate, and, you know, C, hey, look, there is something wrong and I need to get my child some help, or B, your biggest opponent. And
he's going to
stand in your way until, you know, and that's a fine line that I think the high school athletic trainer walks.
Mm-hmm. All right, go ahead, Megan, respond to that.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I've even had parents who kind of do the opposite of that, where I've had athletes, take for football, we do hydration testing in the beginning, and then we weigh athletes in and out of football practice, and if they don't get to their weigh-in weight at the end, the next practice, then they can't practice because they're dehydrated. I've had athletes who I've had to hold out because they can't get back up to their weight. And I've had parents call me and say, hey, why isn't so-and-so practicing? And I said, well, he's not up back to his weight. And he goes, and the parent says, well, he's just not trying to lose some weight right now.
Right.
He's really trying hard. And I said, well, right now is not the time for him to be losing weight, because it's 70 plus degrees outside with 56 plus humidity.
Right.
And I mean, the biggest issue, bigger issue is dehydration and not him losing the weight.
This has nothing to do with whether Johnny ate his, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwich. This is a physiological issue where he was out participating in a sport that requires all this commitment. He just lost too much water weight.
Yep.
You know?
All right. So Dr. Allen, you mentioned this just briefly, but in any of your research, Megan, does social media affect male body image, or did you study that at all?
I dipped a little bit into it. I didn't focus on it by any means, but yes, it does kind of influence it, but it does not directly affect it, as far as I saw in the research and as far as I researched that. So,
I don't think it's as. I'm sorry, Tashara. Go ahead. I don't think. I'm going to respectfully disagree with Megan. I don't think it is as well understood in the male world as it is in the female world, right? And I think mostly because the males don't have the sociological factors that the females have, right? Good or bad, positive or negative, you know. And I'll always use Brett Favre as an example. You know, this guy always looked like he rolled out of bed and walked into the, you know, he's unshaven and, you know, throwing a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and went to go. That's how he went to the office, right? And if you look at a female counterpart, that female counterpart would not, you know, there'd be different sociological factors on that female counterpart. Mm-hmm. With that said, I think that we see sports, you know, swimming and diving, bodybuilding, wrestling, even some other sports, tennis and football and so forth, where the male has to be able to look a certain way. I just don't think that we have enough research right now. Sometimes I think that it goes a different way. You know, for instance, one of the examples that I've always brought up is, let's say you see somebody who's, you know, 6'5", 300 and some odd pounds. A couple things that go into that. One, sociologically, you'd expect that person to play a sport like, you know, definitely football, maybe basketball or something along those lines. But the other part about that is, when that person walks into a room, everybody's going to stare at that person. Look at the size of that guy. When that person goes to buy clothes, he can't go to a normal, you know, place to go buy clothes. He's got to go to a specialty store, the big and tall store. You know, that person has to be able to consume X amount of calories. That person has to do this and that person has to do that. So I think it's a similar phenomenon, but I think that we just don't have enough knowledge and research on what happens to males. So I think that's something that, you know, for instance, we have the female athlete triad. We don't have an analogous combination for the male. You know, we don't have anything that falls into that category. For any athletic trainer out there listening, I think that if you want to explore male sociological factors, that might be an avenue, or not.
I concur. It'd be a great another topic.
Yeah.
It would, yeah.
It would be Megan, this is your doctoral dissertation. That would be it.
Oh, believe me, I have plenty of other research. I have a list of research opportunities that I have tried to dive into.
Do you want to go on and get your doctorate?
Sorry, what?
Do you want to pursue your doctorate?
I've been thinking about it. I know I do enjoy education of athletic training, and I do think that there could be even a whole new course on psychosocial issues in athletes and things like that. As far as getting my doctorate right away, that might be another story.
Mentally, you're taxed. Ashara, I think you had a question.
This may, I don't know if this is a good question or not, but I feel like I should ask it. Yeah. Does peer pressure, do you talk about that in your study? Like, does peer pressure, do you feel like it has a big impact on, you know, the situation with the females and everything?
Absolutely, it does have an impact on it. I didn't focus on that in my research either.
But you talk about it?
I do talk about it, yes. As far as peer other athletes influencing other athletes, it's definitely a phenomenon that happens. But as far to the extent of how it affects individual body satisfaction, it's more of a, well, she is doing this and this. A lot of them talk about using diets and using cleanses and using supplements because others have to lose the weight and things like that. So yes, it does have an influence.
Did you experience a lot of that as far as diets and everything when you were in junior college?
I was
like,
yes.
I'm sorry.
I get where you're going. Yes and no. A lot of the times I was a catcher, so I needed to be able to lift. I thought I needed to squat so much and lift so much weight, and kind of be a little bit bigger because I was in a different type of position. Like the middle infield kind of has a different kind of body image and body composition that they need because they need to be quicker. I obviously needed to be quick, but I also needed to be big to guard the plate. So some of the times I was like, oh, I'm just going to eat all of this food. And other times it was like, maybe I shouldn't eat all of that. So it was kind of a back and forth thing. And that's kind of what I saw in a lot of these responses, is the fact that sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. And it's kind of the majority of the time in which you decide, yes, I do, or no, I don't, kind of is more of the overall factor of more often than not, I feel like I have a positive body satisfaction than I negative body satisfaction.
I think a really interesting topic along those lines is, especially when we see the college and the professional athlete start to come to the end of their career, right? So let's take, you know, football, for instance. You have a professional football player who, for their job, they had to weigh X amount, which means that they had to consume thousands and thousands of calories a day for X amount of years. And then at some point, your job comes to an end. Now what? Right? You can't keep consuming these calories because, you know, it's calories in versus calories out. You're not expending all these, you know, all this calories. So you need to start to back off. And how does your body change from that, right? All of a sudden, you're going to go from this person that's, you know, 6'5", 320, and we're going to try to get you down to 6'5", 260. And, you know, you're going to drop 50, 60 pounds. And how does your eating change? You know, I remember when I was playing football, we were rewarded by cheeseburgers. That was it. It was cheap and there's a lot of dense calories and you can eat as many as you want. And it was totally normal, right? You can show up to In-N-Out Burger, which is where we went, and you can down two or three double doubles. It was awesome. But guess what? When you're done playing, you can't keep up. And that's just, you know, all of a sudden, if you just saw a normal person come in and down three or four double doubles, you'd be like, well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But sociologically, if you saw a whole football team walk in and do that, oh, that's totally normal. Why? Because they're football players. Right? So you have all these different categorizations of sociological phenomenon, et cetera.
And I had a lot of female athletes talk about that too. Well, I don't know what I'm going to do after I get done with sports because I'm a senior and I want to be able to continue exercising and continue really working on my weight after I'm done with sports.
What I found out for me personally is that the biggest factor was me. And when I was done playing, my career got taken away from me. I was injured, and so I just couldn't continue on. And so I didn't have I wasn't able to properly say goodbye, right? I was, you had to go through that whole, death and dying process, you know, the five stages of grief, you know, as your leader, right? Kubler-Ross, the stages of, anyway, finally, when I came on the other side of that, what I had to figure out was, for me, I needed to figure out something else to compete in. That was the missing link. So I would figure out to compete in anything, right? Whether it was competing in weightlifting or karate. And then finally, I figured out how to compete in school, right? I was going to beat the person next to me. If this person scored a 99, I was going to get 100. If this person, you know, put in, you know, X amount of hours in the library, I was going to do one more. I was going to, right? And that, for me, that was the missing link, was I missed the competition. I missed the camaraderie, but I missed the competition. And still to this day, anybody that knows me, right, I'm a very competitive person. And so I would say, okay, well, if your athletic training program did this, then ours is going to do that, right? So I think that's a big factor that a lot of people, I don't mean to be rude, but we got to get going.
You got to keep going?
Yeah, I got to head out. If you guys want to continue on the conversation.
Yeah, I got a couple more questions. So,
May, Tashari, Nicole, do you guys have some more questions?
Well, I have one big one. So, like, what made you pick this topic? Like, what made you want to, like, focus on this topic?
Well, I was running on a treadmill in the University Rec Center, and I was, I think it was February, and USA Today had a segment on something about love your selfie, Dr. Yellen is doing right now.
Yeah, that's right. trying to figure out how to get a group picture of all of us.
and they were talking about all these different things about you should love yourself no matter what, things like that. And I was like, wow, okay, so I'm running on this treadmill. I'm looking at something that says love your selfie. Okay, and it got me really excited because I was like, and I felt really ironic because I was doing something to kind of not necessarily lose weight, but keep up, maintain what I had. And so I was like, how do I put those two things together? And I thought, well, there it is. It's social media because they're trying to put a Twitter hashtag on it. And so I was like, there it is. Social media and body image. And I just put them together.
Yeah. That's great. That's outstanding. I think that you are on the right track, Megan. And if there's anything else that I can do to help you along your journey, please just let me know.
Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck. When do you defend?
Next month.
Yeah. You ready?
Yeah, I am. I'm so excited.
You know, can I give you some advice about your defense?
Absolutely.
Okay. First of all, the people that you're going to defend against already know your stuff because they've been there the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And they want you to do well. They want you to pass.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So between now and then, I want you to practice your defense. I want you to come up with, you know, you have to understand, you ever see like the movie Law and Order or the show Law and Order or CSI, whatever it is?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you know the court scenes where the attorneys get up there and they defend their client?
Uh-huh.
It's the same thing. So just practice. You're going to do great.
Thanks.
And they want you to pass. And the other thing too is that when you're all done, they may ask for some revisions. Get those revisions done as soon as you possibly can and get the document in so that the university can approve it and you walk away with a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
Good job.
That's my plan. Thank you.
All right. Rock on.
Thank you, Megan.
Later.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Sorry. All right. You're good. You're good. All right. So, Megan, you can hear me still, right?
Yep.
All right. So, again, my students left, and so they're supposed to be manning the other thing. But there was another comment. And so give me 1 second. I'm going to go over there and put it up and read it. What are you drinking?
Coffee.
Oh, yuck. I hate coffee.
Oh, come on.
But my wife loves it. So, all right. So Mitchell Russell said, in dealing with the parents of these athletes who are going through psychological stress that have remained silent about their issue or asymptomatic from parents' point of view, how do you recommend explaining to the parents this issue when they see no difference in their child? So
that's really tough. And it goes back on how much education you've had and how you can bring out the education you've already been through and really say, well, here are the findings that I've had I've seen in your kid, and I just want to be there to help them. I'm not trying to accuse. I'm not trying to try to pass this off as you're not doing your job or anything as a parent. And I don't want to say it in a way of being, I guess, like a doctor, because obviously we're not doctors, we're only physician extenders, and I would definitely be the advocate for the kid. I would say, well, this kid is a really great kid, and unfortunately I've seen some of these symptoms, and it's up to you what you do with this information that I'm giving you, but here's what I've seen, here's what I know, And really, I would hope to be able to spark something in the parents that say, well, maybe I can see this in a different light, and really try to be respectful of the parents, their attitude towards it, and say, you know, this isn't concrete, this isn't cut and dry. We also, obviously, there needs to be further testing or further evaluation of this situation. So I would definitely, I wouldn't push it too hard, but I also wouldn't really back down very easily, meaning I would give the information that has been there, and I would be available to speak with the information later at a different time when they may have either calmed down, or if they've seen something that after our conversation that they kind of notice, oh, well, maybe that's what she's talking about. And kind of just go through it in a way of it's an issue, and it can be an issue if we let it grow any further.
Yeah, I responded on the chat, and one of the things I learned from Dr. Crumby when he was talking about youth baseball and throwing, like pitch counts, mm-hmm. well, he just quotes the Little League rules. I said, okay, well, they're not supposed to do this. This isn't just my opinion. This is the rules. This is what you're supposed to do. And so Absolutely. It's kind of the same thing. You're just saying, all right, well, these are the facts. These are the signs. These are the symptoms. These are some of the things that I've noticed. So, you know, here's how you define these. Here's what this looks like. So if you will, I'm on the same team as you. We're just trying to protect your son or daughter. So if you'll just look out for these over the next couple of weeks, then we can, you know, reassess, or maybe I'm wrong, but here is what I'm seeing, just like what you just said. Here's what I'm seeing. Here's my experience. And here's the facts. And so it's not just about, I don't like your kid. I think they're, you know, having a social disorder or eating disorder or disorder mm-hmm. eating or something like that. It's just here's the facts, and this is what my experience and what I've seen. So Mitchell, hopefully that answers your question there. So
mm-hmm.
All right, so we talked briefly about your doctoral research now, according to Dr. Yellen, about
yes.
the male. And I'm 6'1", I'm 210, you know, I lift weights pretty regularly, and so I'm in decent shape, but it's so easy for me to look on Twitter, like I said earlier, and see people, well, I just finished doing this CrossFit workout, or, you know, people doing posting the pictures of like bodybuilders, and I'm thinking, and then I begin to think, well, I'm not good enough, I'm not doing enough. But mm-hmm. then it's also easy for me to go look in the locker room whenever we're getting ready for a football game, and those coaches are not athletic looking. These
yes.
former athletes, I'm like, whoa, you were an athlete? And
yeah.
so social media definitely affects males. It's just like Dr. Yellen was saying, I don't think it's nearly as prevalent or talked about even, but
mm-hmm.
without a doubt, somebody needs to do some research, or maybe I just need to find who is doing the research and
yeah.
from there. So
I've seen a couple of studies on males' body image and social media. A lot of it's also the way that a person uses social media, as far as what they post and what their behaviors are on social media. And like you said earlier, I mean, a lot of the times they want to post the highlights of what they're doing. Like, oh, I feel great because I just worked out. And you're supposed to want to work out all the time, or, you know, working out is a good thing. So that's what they want to post about. And there's the study on, there is a lot less studies on males' body image and social media, but and it could be definitely another research area of me, I guess, or somebody else in the future. But a lot of the research I had gone through is the fact that what people use their social media's accounts for, as far as what they post and their behaviors.
All right. So quickly, Dr. Knobloch, which is Dr. Yellen's counterpart there at the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program, said he's listening, and he just wanted to let me know that the R value is the correlation. So how closely they're correlated.
Yes.
So the closer the R value is to one, the greater the correlation. Zero means no correlation, and negative means an inverse correlation. So for probably most of us that aren't stat junkies, that hopefully helps you understand, and hopefully we'll be able to see Megan's paper at some point later on down the line. All right, so if, like when I was in college, I had some friends that had eating disorders, and I honestly would have never have guessed, because I didn't struggle with it, and, you know, I'm in college, so kind of like what Yellen was saying, you know, your fire-breathing dragon could have come, because there was only really one or two things I was worried about.
Mm-hmm.
So for me as an athletic trainer, I'm a male. Obviously, we deal with a lot of female athletes and a lot of female student athletic trainers. What are some of the things that can help me look out for my students and my student athletes?
Really, What I have thought about, I kind of did a little bit of writing down things before this. A biggest thing is kind of don't be blind and don't be condescending about it. I've seen or heard, and I'm not saying anybody is or isn't, but I've heard of conversations where male athletic trainers are using facts and using concrete statements about why you should or you shouldn't be on this diet to female athletes. And while that's all good and that's what is needed to back up your statements, the male athletic trainers should know that a lot of eating disorders and a lot of body image issues are mostly irrational, and they don't respond to the facts and the concrete statements. Really what needs to happen, or what male athletic trainers should strive to be, is just understanding, and they need to listen. And a lot of it is just knowing why they think this way, and then using the basis of their female athlete, why she thinks about her body that way, and use that to kind of direct her in the sense of, okay, well, if she is 5'6" and you're 5'6", but she's only 110 pounds, which is highly improbable, but and you're 130 pounds, I mean, obviously, yes, she has a different body composition. You just kind of go to more of similarities rather than really big differences in the people that they compare themselves to, and say, okay, well, here's a person who is about your size and about your weight, and what do they do? What's the difference between you and them? And try and see that, understand that difference between them, and why that athlete feels that way is the biggest kind of factor about understanding and seeing body image issues.
So when we talked to Robbie McFarland about the relationship between the coach and the athletic trainer, one of the big things he said, or one of my big takeaways, was understand where they're coming from. So, you know, figure out where that coach is coming from. Maybe he did not sleep at all last night because his kid was sick, and so now he's just yelling at everybody. But, yeah. You know, and so that's kind of what I'm understanding you to say, is that find out where they're coming from and listen to them, and not just spit out a whole bunch of things. Hey, you need to do this, this, and this. Well, that's doesn't help them, because it's irrational. It's not that they thought, hey, this is a great idea, let me, you know, look at myself negatively. Well, it's just because that's what's being put on them, or maybe they're, you know, parents are going through a divorce or something, and they take it out on themselves. So I think that's great advice, and we just need to remember, because it's again about not being selfish and wanting my own way. It's like, I want you to treat me this way, and you know, well, help, let me find out where you are. So it's definitely a learning process for me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, so obviously Super Bowl, Like a Girl campaign with, I think, yes, it was Always. And I think Dove has done some stuff with body image, and I was on Yahoo today. That's where I normally look for just the current event kind of things. And I see a picture with a bunch of different size women in like a white bra and white underwear or something like that. And it's talking about the body image. I don't usually click on those because I don't think it's beneficial for me to look at pictures of women in their underwear.
So I didn't read
the article because I didn't want to click on the picture. But those kind of things, what are your thoughts on those? Because it seems like those are kind of, they're working to counteract. So
yes, and those ad campaigns are great. They're a great start. I looked into the Like a Girl advertisements, and I looked into their experiments and kind of research about that. And really, they're just trying to get people to look at themselves in a different way. And that is a really big issue. That's like one of the big things in trying to change your mind about yourself. And once you change your mind about yourself, things can change really quickly. The Like a Girl talked about being a social experiment, and the fact that if we show these images, are we gonna see a shift in people's body image about themselves, or something like that? And it's really great. There's been studies about being shown pictures of thin ideal media or neutral media where there's really not even a model in there, or like strong and sexy models or something like that. But then they, in the study, they do another exercise to kind of take back that what they've just been exposed to. So they, with the people who saw the thin ideal media, their they're going to show, do an exercise with the participants saying, okay, so why do you feel worse about yourself after seeing this? And why is that? And what can we do to change that? Because once a person sees this thin idea media, they might internalize that ideal and go after it as far as their diet, their workout habits and things like that. But once they get into that second exercise, they say, okay, well, here's what's the difference between you as an actual person and that model or that thin ideal media that was you were just shown? Well, there's a lot of different things. There's Photoshop, there's photo enhancers, there's, you know, lights that are perfectly shown upon that model or that thin ideal media, stuff like that. So there have been studies that try to attenuate or lessen the effects of all of this different advertisement and all of this different media. And Like a Girl, this Like a Girl advertising is really great for that. And I think it's a great first step, and there needs to be a lot more taken.
I agree. At first I was like, I saw the one, what does it mean to throw like a girl? And it just kind of throws you off. It's kind of like, are they making fun of girls? Or, and then, mm-hmm. and then you kind of, you watch it and you realize. And so I think it's a great idea. And that, and Dove's been doing stuff like that for, you know, I don't know how long, a couple years or something. Mm-hmm. And so, I think it's really cool to see. And my wife loves it. And she said, you have to mention that as you're mm-hmm. talking about females and social media. So that
Absolutely.
Was, that was for you. Beautiful. So one of the things, like I teach Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University class, and one of the things he just said in the lesson that we taught on Monday was there's an elephant in the room and you have to eat it. Well, how do you eat it? Just one bite at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of the same thing as just one small step at a time, just one small step at a time. We've got to find out where they are. We've got to listen to them. You've got to begin to, I don't know, maybe even not put your best image out on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Just put your real life. Mm-hmm. And so that people see, hey, there are other people struggling with the way their body looks, or there are other volleyball players that are, you know, comfortable with being a little bit heavier and, you know, having a little bit of cellulite at the bottom of their spandex right there. And so, mm-hmm. so, you know, just if we can get begin people to think that way, that, hey, this is who I am, this is the way that I was made, then go from there. And not just idealize, you know, Lolo Jones or something like that. Well, you're not an Olympic track athlete. She is.
Yeah.
She has to fit that body type.
Absolutely.
Know? So she's not going to be squatting and playing softball, you know, that just that kind of thing. So
mm-hmm.
I think this was a great conversation. Do you have any parting thoughts, any big takeaways from the conversation today?
I mean, the big takeaway is kind of meet that athlete or that female athlete in the middle. I think that's one of the most important trips that athletic trainers can take sometimes, is meeting somebody in the middle and really finding out and understanding why they're feeling certain ways. A lot of the stuff that I've been learning in this graduate program is the fact that your psychological well-being is just as important as your musculoskeletal well-being. It also plays a factor in how long you're feeling injured or your knee hurts or something like that. It can affect a lot of different things. So it's, yes, sports are important, and sports are really awesome for female athletes as far as being successful later in life too. But the biggest thing right now is to meet that athlete in the middle and see where they are and kind of go from there to be able to treat them appropriately.
All right. So I got one more comment from the people watching. It is that it's not just bigger people struggling with wanting to be skinny. It's also,
yeah.
I mean, my wife is thin, and she hears it all the time. Oh, you're too skinny, or, oh, you're so mm-hmm. thin, you don't need to work out. Well, that doesn't help. That only makes the problem worse. And so.
Absolutely. So, it can go both ways.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I hear it with these girls, like skinny girls saying, oh, I'm so fat. And then they're standing in front of it like a bigger girl who is probably struggling, you know, with, hey, I'm overweight. And, mm-hmm. you know, what does that do to that other girl? So, again, one bite at a time. We've got to work together to create a positive body image. Just, hey, this is who you are. Just enjoy who you are. So,
Absolutely.
Skinny, medium, big, whatever, just one bite at a time.
Absolutely.
All right, very cool. Well, if you'll hang on just 1 second, Megan, I'll close it out.
Awesome.
So tonight we have the Greater Houston Athletic Trainer Society meeting, where we wrap up from our workshop. where we had almost 1,100 student athletic trainers there on a Saturday morning to learn and to do some cool stuff. And so tonight we have that meeting. And through that organization, which is the Greater Houston Athletic Trainer Society, we are able to offer the CEUs. And I think there was 5 or 6 people logged in today, able to earn CEUs. So if that's something you're interested in while you're sitting at lunch, you can log in for as long as you can. And whenever the certificate's available, you just write down your, 45 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour and a half, because most of them are 90 minutes long. So it's a great opportunity to earn CEUs. And at this time, there's no charge at all. And so you can possibly earn an hour and a half every week of CEUs for no charge. And then that way, when your district gives you some money, you can go spend it on a nice little vacation more than the course. I'm just kidding. Don't do anything illegal. and so just the support there, I really want to thank the GHATs for everything they're doing there. And then my wife has been really amazing and supporting of the podcast and everything I'm doing there. Obviously, she's listening and she's giving me a lot of good feedback for this. And also, now's about the time where I'm getting some feedback after I've been doing this about 3 years. We get people watching live. I'm getting several different emails and I guess some good responses from some people who I would like to talk to. So that's looking good there in the future. If you want to check out our website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, where almost every single Wednesday we're going live. And then, again, you can earn the CEUs or you can watch later. You can download the podcast, which is the audio-only version. But at this time, we don't offer CEUs for the podcast because it's on your own, and I don't have any way to track whether you're listening or not. If you want to follow me on Twitter, PHS Sports Med. If you're watching, maybe not logged in, but you still want to ask questions, usually using the hashtag DSMB on Twitter. And I try to watch that as best I can, so you can ask your questions there. That way, if Megan or whoever else the guest is can answer your question, that way you can get it asked. On Google Plus, it's Sports Medicine Broadcast 2, I think, because there was a problem with the page 1. And then Facebook.com/PHS Athletic Training, that's for the athletic training here at Pasadena High School. Well, I am Jeremy Jackson, Megan Jeffress from, where are you from, Megan?
Missouri State University.
Because I know Dr. Yellen was saying Washington earlier, but...
Well, yes, I am from Washington, but right now I'm in Missouri.
Yeah. So I knew that wasn't exactly correct, but I just couldn't remember where. Mm-hmm. All right. So for Jeremy here in Pasadena, Megan there in Missouri at the Masters of Athletic Training program there. All my sports medicine one kids that were here. He had Nicole Kasha, Dr. Yellen, Tashari Lewis. Well, that's a wrap. All right. So... I stopped this recording, but it's still streaming live, Megan, and I'm going to go stop those in just a second, but how do you think it went?
I think it went really well, and I think I have a lot to learn from Dr. Yellen.
Yeah, he's... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say he's a really smart guy, and I definitely could use him as a resource.
Yeah, and he's real helpful, and it's actually the way it happened is I was doing the podcast, and at the end of last school year, they said, hey, we'd be interested in coming on and to talk about our program. So, they came on, we talked, and normally they were about an hour long then. So they come on, Dr. Yellen and I block, and then we go for 2 hours, me and the other athletic trainer here, and those guys, we just talk for like 2 hours. So yeah. Then they come back in like 2 weeks, and we go for like another 2 hours. And I'm like, dang. So then he was like, hey, man, we'd like to come as often as possible. And then now they have their students coming. So it's a great chance for us to teach those students and then for me to learn what they need, for me to learn from them. Because, I went through an internship program at Houston Baptist University. And it honestly, I don't know how I got prepared to pass the state and national mm-hmm. exam, but I did. And, I guess it's just by the grace of God. And I don't want those to have the same deal. I want to make sure that they have the opportunity to take advantage of each educational opportunity and not just do the job at the minimum so that they can go play hide and seek with the rest of the guys in the courtyard or whatever it is, whatever we were doing, crawling through the tunnels. But so it's really cool for me to have them as part of it. So and he's definitely helpful. So hit him up. So.
Yeah, I was looking through a lot of the other podcasts, and a lot of the information is really great. I've written down a lot of the podcasts that I really want to listen to eventually when I have time on my hands again. and I'm looking forward to seeing more.
Very cool, very cool. And if there's anything you want to hear about, you can, let me know, and then we can cover that. Or if there's something else, you're like, hey, me and my friend here, or me and my boss had this really cool topic or had this issue, and we'd like to address it. Like we had one of our guys here, Bubba Wilson, he had a 16-year-old kid have a stroke, and Memorial Hermann did a video about it, and, you know, I was just watching that story in there, but it's just something that you don't see, but it's good for athletic trainers to know. So if y'all have something like that going on, or the guy here at U of H, he had one of his players get hit in the chest, and it ripped the inferior vena cava or inferior aorta.
Yeah, I read about that. That was crazy.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's one of those things that it never happens, but if you have a story like that, well, let's hear it. You know, let's help everybody else. So anytime you got something like that, just feel free to let me know. Or like I said, a topic you want covered or something like that. So
awesome. Bye.